This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to what has become the annual reflection of Palace 1, Brighton 1 and this week's FYP podcast. I'm your host Jack Pearce and joining me to discuss the Brighton match, answer your questions and a little bit more are Dominic Firefield of The Athletic. How are you, Dom?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you doing? Are you okay, Jack?
Good, thank you. Yes, a fun jaunt back down to the coast last night after the Brighton game. We just played some tunes and didn't really talk about the football because I knew I'd be doing it today. So, yeah, I'm feeling good. Just signed off for work for the Christmas period too. So, yeah, all good. Full of festive vibes, and hopefully we'll bring that to this episode. And fresh from this week's post-match pod, as well as some last-minute Christmas shopping, it's the South London Press's Edmund Brack. How are you, Ed?
I'm very well, thank you, Jack. Yeah, very well. I feel like Jean-Philippe Mateta, back-to-back performances, back-to-back outings. So, yeah, hopefully I deliver a stunning display like he did yesterday.
Well, if we're saying that you're in the best form of your life, then we've had a good episode come the end of this episode.
Yeah.
But lackluster and frustrating. But enough about your shopping trip, Ed. We'll get onto the football in a moment. But before we do get into the football, a few quick messages. And firstly, from our friends at Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. 'Tis the season for festive football, and the best way to watch it, down at your local Green King Sports pub, of course. After all, Christmas is a time to catch up with friends, old and new, so get the team to your local for refreshing pints, delicious food, and live action of every Christmas cracker. Every fixture from TNT, Sky Sports, and Amazon is live at Green King Sport venues this Christmas. That means wall-to-wall action at their huge HD screens. Head to your local Green King and watch every winning goal, top bids volley and dodgy VAR decision in an atmosphere worth sharing. Download the Green King Sport app and you'll receive 10% off drinks every single time there's sports on the TV. We'd also like to thank our patrons for their continued support. If you'd like to support FYP by joining our Patreon, you can by subscribing at patreon.com/FYP podcast. Options start at the price of a coffee per month, and it gets you access to the post-match podcast and ad-free versions of this midweek pod. And finally, as we revealed this week on our socials, Jim and I had the pleasure of interviewing Neil Warnock this week for our January episode of the interview series. Neil is on tour next year and will be at Plough Lane next June. So if you're still looking for a last-minute present for a loved one who'd enjoy an afternoon hearing all his tales from his long career, visit gotoagig.com. We'll also include the link in our show notes. This month's interview was with the legend that is James McArthur, and that is now available to all listeners wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, on with the pod, and let's talk Palace Brighton. Dom, your thoughts on the match as a whole, but perhaps whether you saw it as some others did, in that it was a game of two halves.
I wouldn't necessarily go that far. I think the first half performance looked a lot better after we saw how Brighton played in the second half. There was a period in the first half, in the first 20 minutes, where Brighton had a complete monopoly of the ball. I mean, we weren't getting a touch. But it was done at a pace that was comfortable for us to deal with, and we could control defensively. We could nullify them and control the situation and make them look what they were, which was pretty blunt in the final third. And we had our own little forays forward and probably as many in that first half, in that little period just before the break, as we had in a little shorter period in the second half, when we were meant to be, you know, we ostensibly didn't see the ball and were backs to the wall throughout. I thought that as soon as Brighton injected some energy and dynamism and forward thrust into their play, a bit of more urgency, basically, they looked a class apart. I'm sorry, they just looked a class apart. They kept the ball better. If they had a finisher in the team, a more natural finisher, they would have scored a lot more goals to reward that monopoly of the ball. But that's not revelatory. I mean, that's we've been saying that about Brighton for about 5 years. I think it was a really admirable, resilient, and lucky performance from Crystal Palace to get through with a point and to emerge with a point. In many ways, as admirable as the point at Manchester City on Saturday. I know we're not allowed to say that about Brighton because Brighton are our rivals, but there were times yesterday when I watched that game and thought, bloody hell, they're good. They're a really good team. And the way that they're technically proficient all over the pitch, and the fluidity of their movement, and the fact they flood the opposition half with players, it makes them so difficult to control.
Their movement was about as impressive as I've seen at Selhurst for a really, really long time. The creation of space by the lines that players are nowhere involved with the ball create for others. I mean, you just have to see how, I think, Hinchelwood, who started at right back, was just in the final third as much as he was. I think, Ed, you mentioned that in the post-match pod. The lines they run, some of the best directed team movement by a manager I've seen for a really long time. However, that doesn't combat the air of frustration amongst a significant proportion of the Palace fan base at full time last night, with fans especially cross in terms of Palace's own approach to that second half. We've had a few comments, and I'll cite a couple now. More comments rather than questions, which is why it's probably working them in this part. So Mark Drew, worst second half performance I've seen in a long time. We were just chasing the ball around, and the odd time we got the ball, we gave it straight back to Brighton. Mark, I don't know if you were at Bournemouth a couple of weeks ago, but that was not a good night, and I'd probably say that was a worse second half performance. Daniel, Dan of the South rather than Dan of the North, why do we always sit so deep when leading games when we've known for years we always slip up at the end? I think it's one of those that, had Brighton not scored and we were looking at this as a fantastic win, could be arguing that Roy Hodgson had orchestrated some degree of tactical masterclass. And then finally, just in this part, just on this point before we come to Ed, Dan Welsh cites the performance and describes the performance such as Luke and Matt Dross, presumably a reference to Camberley's finest boy band, who, despite my best efforts, I can't make a Palace-related link to. So I'll age myself, and likely most listeners, by asking Ed if he knows who Bross are.
No, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm sorry. No.
Dom,
you are kidding me, surely.
No, honestly, yeah. No idea.
You, you've got nothing
what
on
song,
that.
What was their hit?
When will I be famous? And You Owe Me Nothing, I think, are probably the two that most people would. You got nothing.
No, it's okay. Gone straight over my head. I'm sorry. No, I hope I haven't offended everyone with that.
No, okay.
Have a lovely Christmas, both. I'll see you later. Not that I'm a fan. I hated them, but even so. Well, surely they must have done the rounds on reality TV in the last few years. I mean, surely. No? Oh, God. Oh, I'll just,
one of them did Strictly, but then Ed doesn't strike me as a Strictly fan. But they also and if any listener hasn't watched this, perhaps one of the best mockumentaries, despite the fact I don't think it was meant to be a mockumentary. But, yeah, they reformed. But anyway, thank you for the slight distraction there, Dan Welsh. But Ed, did we invite the equaliser, or was it a case of Brighton just improving in the second half? But as Dom says, they had moments in the first half too. But particularly, I guess, following that double change at halftime, in terms of Danny Welbeck providing more of a focal point at the top of the pitch, and also Buonanotte, who played, I thought, really well when he came in, and particularly caused issues from their right-hand side. But from your perspective, was it our creation, or did Brighton just, you know, deserve that point because of their performance?
I don't think we can't say that they didn't deserve the point. With the amount of ball, the ball that they had, the chances that they created, the number of blocks and interceptions, last-ditch challenges that we put in, it always felt like they were going to get that equaliser. As you mentioned, the two changes that they made at half-time, I actually thought that we came out of the second half with a little bit more ascendancy than Brighton probably should have. I know that he sent them out early, De Zerbe, with a little bit of a rocket. But Selzy mentioned after that it was Jason Steele who sort of gave him the rocket. Did he say that in the pod, or have I just done that off the top of my head?
He did say it in the pod.
He did.
Right.
Okay, very good. And so they've obviously come out, but they looked a little bit timid. I thought that was maybe another chance where we could have capitalised. But then when those changes start to implement the game, Welbeck, a real focal point up top for them. Buonanotte was sort of controlling it in the middle, passing it around. I mean, it's remarkable, really, that Brighton can lose McAllister, Estupiñán via injury, Caicedo to Chelsea, bring in these unknown sort of talents. I'm not going to say I've heard of many of them before they come to the Premier League. And they're exceptional talents who look like they're going to go on and do sort of similar things in the game. It's sort of the thing really that struck me most about Crystal Palace's season. I saw it again when we played Bournemouth the other Wednesday. Bournemouth had the ability to take off their best three attackers and bring on three similar calibre of players who were able to kill off the game. Brighton had the ability to bring on two amazing players at halftime for their squad to influence the scoreline. Palace don't have the ability to truly impact games off the bench because the squad is so thin, the squad is so weak in the wide areas especially. We saw when Jean-Philippe Mateta went down with around 15 minutes to go via cramp, and he delivered a sensational performance in terms of the way that he battled up against Lewis Dunk, but there was no options to change it. We just had to try and hang on in there, and it was quite clear with Eber Echieze's sort of involvement that he wasn't quite fit. So it was a well-deserved point for Brighton. I don't really side with the people who I've seen quite a lot of sort of anger towards the result on social media this morning. I'm not quite sure where that comes from, because our last three performances, barring a Jordan Ayew red card, which is debatable, you're looking at 5 points potentially. So, yeah, I'm not too sure why the sort of animosity towards the performance last night. I guess it comes because Crystal Palace's home form in 2023 has been pretty dire. I think it's 4 wins in the calendar year at Selhurst Park. So when you're coming up against your rivals, you're leading for quite a significant period. And then I guess fans feel like you've sat deep and invited the pressure. But the truth is, the way Brighton controlled the ball, it's like you're playing Manchester City again. It was the way the fullbacks overlap, the way they control it in front of your penalty box, sort of powerless a little bit to it. So, yeah, a good point heading into a couple of crucial games before the turn of the year.
Yeah, you mentioned the squad then, and Dom, plenty of talk about the general approach, but what did you think of the subs that Roy did make, and can extend on Ed's point there about maybe, the lack of options, which is kind of a weekly topic of conversation. But specifically Ebbs, who I think we have to be honest was clearly not ready to come on, and had two key moments in terms of his half an hour on the pitch. One was the missed chance, which I think a fitter Ebbs is a lot sharper and takes that, and he's more clinical with his decision making. But also his role in what led to the Brighton equaliser. And obviously he doesn't lead to the goal directly. It's a magnificent header by Danny Welbeck, but he does give the ball away in a part of the pitch that no team wants to turn the ball over. So just in terms of the subs generally, your thoughts on those, and also maybe just a word on Ebbs.
I thought Roy Hodgson was very honest in his post-match, basically said that he got the subs wrong. I mean, that they didn't have the desired effect at all. And this time he wasn't talking about, you know, young players going on and just struggling. I mean, although Ozo did come on, I didn't think he did okay. I mean, relatively speaking, even in a difficult circumstance. But yeah, it was Eze. It was a player coming on to replace Jordan Ayew, who's obviously on four bookings and risking a suspension for the Chelsea game. Taking him off and bringing Eze on, but then it didn't work. He was horribly rusty. I thought that the clearance was just, I mean, it's awful. It's absolutely awful, unfortunately. And it just presents Brighton with the possession in a central area as well. Not even out wide. It's just terrific. And I felt for him on the chance and the subsequent corner as well, where his volley went down into the ground. That was slightly harder, but he just looked a player that was off the pace, which is completely understandable. But on the other hand, I'm just sitting there thinking, well, what would have happened had Jordan Ayew come off and he put Jeffrey Schlupp's number up? The outrage in the stadium would have been, I mean, it would have been too much. I don't know for sure. And someone, maybe one of our listeners could correct me if this is the case, but the television cameras panned to Roy at the final whistle. Once he'd shaken hands with De Zerbi, and he appeared to be talking to somebody off camera and sort of smiling in a sort of, I don't know, what do you want me to do sort of way here? Arms out, stretched. And I don't know for sure. He might have been talking to one of his own players. But I suspect he was talking to a member of the crowd who was presumably frustrated at something. Probably the absence of Matthias França on the pitch. Probably. That's just me guessing, because it seems to be the recurring theme at the moment. But that's where we're at the moment, unfortunately. Schlupp probably would have done a decent job on the left. I can actually see the argument. I know Selzy put it out there last night that Branson might have made a difference just to give Brighton something to think about. But the reality of the situation is that Brighton were building up a head of steam when he made the substitutions. When the player was on the pitch, when Eze was on the pitch, we actually created our three chances in the second half in next to no time, with the two chances for him and the one for Mateta with the shot over the bar. Eze was on the pitch at that point. So if one of those goes in, again, it looks more like a masterstroke than a poor decision. And ultimately, when those chances didn't go in, Brighton just built up this momentum and forced us back. It wasn't Palace wanting to sit deep. They were desperate to get out of it. They just simply couldn't. There was all the momentum was with Brighton and the quality, and they were pinning us back. And our defending got, our attempts at clearances got ever more wild. I mean, it was like, let's just get it upfield, get it anywhere. Sometimes we overplayed when we thought, oh, we can't keep pumping it upfield because it keeps coming back. So let's build up. And oh my God, it's panic stations there as well. It was just one of those horrible choking suffocations by Brighton until the goal came. And the irony was the goal, when it came, was an absolutely unbelievable header into a tiny little area of the goal. I mean, absolutely astonishing goal, considering the number of chances that they missed that were so much simpler.
Yeah, in terms of their entries into our penalty area, you felt the goal was going to come from one of the slick interchanges in the penalty area, and instead it comes from what I would hazard, by the end of the season, we might be talking about the best-headed goal in the Premier League this season. That really is quite a goal. I don't think I really appreciated it at the time, because I was so furious with the way that we'd given the ball away so cheaply, but it is an incredible goal. He has, you know, as you say, Dom, nowhere to put it other than where he did, and he scored. So, yeah, you know, Danny Welbeck off the bench, proven quality. Adam Lallana for the last 20 minutes, I thought, changed it up. His movement is very good, and it freed up Pascal Gross, who went wide right. So, yeah, it did compare the two squads and the subs. And I think whatever Roy had done at that moment, if he hadn't bought Ebson, we'd probably be talking about why he didn't bring Ebson.
Jack, just to interject, then I'll shut up for at least 10 minutes. They had a £100 million rated striker on the bench who didn't even come on. Yeah. He wasn't even required.
Was he on the bench for them last night?
Yeah, Evan Ferguson was there and just wasn't even required on the pitch. So, yeah. I mean, and they've got injuries, serious injuries as well.
It just bears the reality of the situation, which really no Palace fan, even the most honest Palace fan, really wants to accept, that they are just in a better place than we are right now, particularly in terms of playing staff. Achini, just in terms of Ebs, does ask whether he wants to ban Ebbs from ever playing on the wing again. I don't know if we can ban him, but we can certainly maybe utilise him in more effective parts of the vision. But he does fairly point out that perhaps Schluppy or Franca would perhaps have been a better outlet given the nature of the game at that point. The way Ebbs played last night, it was akin to the performance he offered when he first came back from this horrendous Achilles injury that happened against Villa. I seem to remember him coming on with us 2-0 down, and he just looked like a player really not ready to be playing first team football. And I just feel he came on last night in a way because it was Brighton at home. And I do feel there's really no option for Roy at the moment. I don't think there's any win for Roy in his squad selection because of the dearth within it. But we'll close part one with a more positive air about us. And without preempting 3-2-1 too much, Ed, were there players last night who did impress you? We talked about David Ozo. I think probably the best thing about David Ozo's appearance last night was the fact he got more minutes. And I'm probably with Dom in that I didn't think he added much to us, but he was quite tidy on the ball and did, you know, get about. He didn't go hiding. But Michael Olise showed some absolutely fantastic touches again and just proved what a talent he was. But in view of kind of going into part two a little bit more positively and hopefully bringing some of the listeners with us, who stood out for you last night?
I thought Nathaniel Clyne actually was excellent up against Matoma. I think it was only once where Matoma actually got round the back of him, and that was when he went down under the sort of soft challenge that the referee waved away the penalty claims pretty quickly. And when I watched it back on the replay, it looked like he hit his foot into the ground, so no contact there whatsoever. Jefferson Lerma did really well, as always. A shrewd piece of business to bring him in on a free transfer. There was that period when he had that, after that hamstring injury, where you sort of felt like his early season form maybe went away from him a little bit, but he's found that back and a sensational player for us. The sort of player that we need.
Well, sorry to interrupt, Ed, but I think Jefferson Lerma is the embodiment of shrewd signing on a free transfer. He is literally referred to that, I think, most weeks on this podcast, other Palace podcasts, and now, halfway through the season, other Premier League watchers are thinking, what a good signing. That was, sorry, interrupted your flow, but just wanted to ram home the effectiveness of... He's a very good signing.
He's the sort of signing we need to be making more of, players with Premier League experience. Obviously, players with that sort of experience don't come up on a free as often, but as you saw in the summer, the players who were available on loan, the Harrisons, the Sinisteras, people who have played in this division before and know what it's about, Palace needs to be doing more of that, because at the moment we're placing our reliance on youngsters, Ahmed, Franca, because we have nothing else to sort of pin our hopes on. We lose arguably our greatest ever player when we fail to replace him. So it's, you know, if Roy Hodgson is turning around looking to a fan asking what can he do, what else can he do? I'm sort of bewildered as to what the options are, because every time I see Ahmed come on, I'm not convinced that he's quite ready to be starting in Premier League games. I haven't really seen him impact one too much off the top of my head. I haven't seen it where I thought Ahmed has come on and he's shown real sort of glimpses here. There was maybe a little bit of early promise under Patrick Vieira, but ever since then, since Roy's come back, it's been incredibly, well, stop-start for him. It's very sort of in-out in terms of substitutes appearances. He still hasn't made a Premier League start for us. But in terms of positives, I thought Jean-Philippe Mateta was excellent last night and really benefiting from a sort of run in the team and the January transfer window opening by the looks of it, because every single time it rolls around.
Tis the season for Jean-Philippe.
He seems to find this extra gear where... I was having the conversation last night with Sel. He's not... It's weird because he's not really an aerial sort of prowess, is he? I mean, last night he battled really well up against Lewis Dunk, but really good at holding the ball up and sort of very technical in terms of the way that he plays. What is the role you want from a Crystal Palace striker? That's to bring Michael Olise and Ebru Ezeheze into play. And if he's doing something like that week in, week out, I'm not sure Crystal Palace are probably going to want to lose him, because he does offer something to the team. And that's the sort of gamble you get with buying strikers in the Premier League. If you look at Everton, they bought Beto, was it for 30 million, something along those lines? Does he have a Premier League goal to his name as of yet?
I think he has one against Newcastle.
One, okay.
Do you know how much money that Everton put down on Beto? Do you know how much money they've actually paid for it?
No.
Exclusive, Dom.
No.
Nothing.
Oh, one of those deals.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow, okay.
Udinese needed the dosh, I'm guessing, in a couple of years' time, maybe. Yeah, okay. Or VIP tickets for Bramley Dock. I don't know, one of them. Maybe Udinese are the opening game at Bramley Dock in a couple of years' time. Who knows? But In terms of Mateta, yeah, there was a particular moment last night. I'll probably save it for 3-2-1 because I suspect he may well feature. But there was a particular moment which got all of Selhurst excited, and it was a good moment. One thing we have ignored is we did actually score a goal last night. We probably should just have a moment on it. Dom, the goal, from your perspective, was it reward for a particularly good 5-10 minute period of Palace's?
Yeah, and it's actually that was actually maybe part of the frustration, because Brighton look like a team. I think that's 22 games now they've gone with conceding a goal in every single match.
Longest run in the Premier League. Yeah,
I mean it's there is a vulnerability about them at the back, and for all that Lewis Dunk looked a Rolls Royce for periods, he also, I think the whole way that they play and this insistence on building short from the back is. It has an element of risk to it. And when Palace got the press right, and Jean-Philippe Mateta is not a natural presser of a back line, I don't think that's his favoured role particularly, but there was a period last night where it did work, and Jordan Ayew's hassling on one side and the threat that Elise carried, not necessarily physically as in running at people, but actually them knowing that, my God, we don't want him to get the ball because he could do anything with it. That did prompt a little period of panic and a little flurry there towards the end of the first half, which was rewarded. I mean, you know, a properly panicked goalkeeper into a terrible clearance, a very, very smart pass from Husey to liberate Elise again, and an absolutely sublime cross for Ayew at the back post. And the only regret of it was, if you look at Hughes and Elise when the goal goes in, they don't celebrate because they're convinced there must be an offside in this, and it's not going to count. And that is VAR again, just utterly draining a situation in a derby match of all that sort of exuberance and ecstasy, whatever. It was so that annoyed me about it, but it was actually a really nice header, a really good goal, and thoroughly well deserved for that little period where we were able to get at them. But I don't know, maybe a combination of the fact that we worked so feverishly in that first half to create the chances that we did by putting that back line under pressure and chasing the ball throughout, and Brighton having more options off the bench to make a difference, maybe explains why we looked as if we were running through treacle for most of the second half.
Mm. Yeah, it's a difficult one to take, but hopefully there are enough positives with players still to come back. And maybe we'll get into that as we preview Chelsea and Brentford. But as Bracker said, 2 points from those three games, and it could justifiably have been more than that, given the nature of the Liverpool result. But just, after the ball,
sorry, I'd be curious to know, Dom. I asked the question, obviously, on the post-match pod last night about whether he thought that Eberich Eze sort of rushed himself back from injury a little bit just because he's missed a chunk of the season already and then drops out of the England squad because of it. Do you feel like maybe he's rushed himself back a tiny bit? I know the Euros are obviously in the summer, but to get himself back in the forefront of Gareth Southgate's mind heading into the summer.
I think given that he came so close to making one of the previous tournaments when the Achilles struck back in, what year was that? 2021, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think there will be a desperation to be in the squad and to experience that. But I doubt that was the motivation in at this period. I think I suspect that he was actually just desperate to play football. I mean, the reality is England squad doesn't convene again until March, at the earliest. I can't even remember. They're usually fixtures in March, aren't they? If he was thinking in terms of just being fit for the summer tournament, then there's actually an argument that he'd sat out another 2 or 3 weeks and made sure he had a proper run of games through January, February, so that he was in form and in rhythm when that squad was announced. I suspect and hope that he wanted to get back to help Crystal Palace out of a particularly nasty predicament in terms of the lack of options available to Roy Hodgson. And this is a player that desperately wants to play football. I imagine he also wants to play football with his big mate Michael Olise, who is, I mean, when the pair, and we saw it in glimpses against Everton, we saw it in glimpses against Luton, and that's pretty much it, really, in terms of us seeing them together this season. And you know, we're all desperate to see them in tandem together and tearing it up. And Palace need that. They need that to give themselves a chance of opening up teams and actually pulling away from trouble and safely up into mid-table and higher in this division. And I hope that was the main motivation before, you know, behind his speedy return from the ankle problem.
The 2 points that some perceived that we dropped last night would have taken us back to 12th, which would have been a lovely place to be for Christmas, as it really is home. So that's one regret of mine last night. Okay, thank you, gents. Let's call time on part one there. Join us after the break when Dom and Brackers will be answering your questions.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the FYP podcast, sponsored by Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. Question time, and we've had plenty come to us in full time, some of which we've already covered in the first part's conversation. So I thought what we'd do is broaden the questions to a more generic conversation rather than game specific as we head towards Christmas. So firstly, a couple, one from Jeff Bartner. Is it fair to say that the board's gamble to provide Roy with little to no reinforcement has paid off? If the team plays as hard as the past three games and has an average January window, it seems 12th to 15th finish is inevitable. And Andy Boulding adds to that, if we don't add any... Well, sorry, he adds to the conversation, doesn't add to the point. If we don't add any quality in January, can we avoid the drop? So I guess in terms of those two conversations, it's really about the approach that the board have taken. Ed, let's look at January, and from your perspective, regardless of the results and performances that come in the games against Chelsea and Brentford, do you feel there's an absolute necessity to bring bodies into that squad?
Without a shadow of a doubt, there's been a necessity since the transfer window closed on was it August 31st, September 1st, whichever one it was. I mean, the fact that Tyreek Mitchell's never really had proper competition and cover at left back needs to be addressed. The fact when Sheik Doucouré picks up that, so there's such a cruel Achilles injury up against Luton, that needs to be addressed now. Chris Richards is doing a fine job in there, and I'm more than happy with him in terms of his mobility. But I think you saw maybe a little bit in that first half that he struggled to adapt to the game. Yeah. I noticed that he and Mark Gahey were sort of switching positions when Gahey would drive forward. Funny enough, I actually didn't mind Gahey in that role. I think he reads the game really well. But Palace desperately need more cover in that area. And as I mentioned earlier, they never replaced Wilfried Zaha. So there's this sort of key areas of the squad which needs to be addressed. But the problem is, if there isn't much money to go about, or if we're relying on outgoings then to bring in more incomings, it's a lot to do within a month. So my hope would be that sort of plans, and I'm pretty sure that plans are probably already in place to bring people in, to get sort of the wheels in motion in terms of making sure that we're not scrambling around on January 31st or February 1st to try and get the bodies in. But in terms of squad depth, I think it's been the common theme for every Crystal Palace podcast, every Crystal Palace discussion I've had and since the season started, really. The squad is paper thin in the wide areas. We knew Michael Olise and Mateus Franchi were injured at the start of the season. Had to sort of forego points at the start of the campaign to sort of just try and get by. The Nottingham Forest game, the Fulham game at home, these were games that were very winnable at that stage of the season, but we didn't have the squad to really compete with it. Somehow we're on a certain number of points, and I think it's a little bit of a miracle, really, that we have that many points, considering Michael Olise and Eberich Yeze have only played 80 minutes in total or something along those lines. So there is, without a shadow of a doubt, a need to strengthen this squad in key areas, because for too long it's been sort of just trying to get by with season after season. I think it was the thing that Steve Parrish said on the podcast that he did. Was it the BBC one with Gary Lineker, where he said, if you give Roy a set...
I think it's the not BBC Gary Lineker podcast.
It's not BBC Gary Lineker podcast. Okay.
Goalhanger Productions.
Yeah. Whichever one it was. He said, if you give Roy a certain number of players, he gets this result, that result, and then this the other result. Yeah, if we give Roy an incredible set of players, I think it would be almost in dreamland of what we could achieve. But we haven't done that. We've chosen to go down a different route, whether that's due to the stadium, other areas of the squad. Obviously, we need to rebuild again in the summer if we lose others. So plenty of factors in play. But I'd hope that just to secure our... I don't think we're going to go down. But just to make it a bit more of a comfortable second half of the season, I'd like to see extra bodies brought in.
Dom, share the sentiment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the squad is worse than it was last year. It's not as deep. It's lacking in key areas, as Ed makes obvious. Do I believe that they will have the ability to go into the market in January and make the improvements? Well, I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I think history teaches us how the club likes to do business, how the club can do business, and there will be bigger fish than us fishing in the same pond. Yeah, unfortunately, next month. And I don't think it'll be easy to do, but it's desperately needed. It's funny, really, the whole thing. I mean, when Palace lose matches from now on in, you know, if they get beaten at Stamford Bridge or they lose to Brentford, these games are being played out with the... And I hope he forgives me this if you ever get to talk to him. But the spectre of Steve Cooper hovering over this, there is now a manager available who we know Palace have looked at in the past, who is available now. I'm not saying that he's, you know, he's on the verge of joining or anything like that. But now it's a different dynamic to everything from now on in, because Roy Hodgson, who we know his contract runs out at the end of this season, and the team is not okay. It's 9 points above the relegation zone as we speak, but that's a bit of a deceptive position because Luton have got two games in hand. It feels as if an element of the crowd has turned, and it's not an easy situation. It's a tense situation. So every time there's a defeat, it's going to feel cataclysmic, potentially, for him, it could prompt change. That's the reality of it. Unless somebody comes out and just says, no, Roy's here until the end of the season. We'll give him the resources that he needs in January to keep us out of trouble. And then we'll part our ways and we'll move on as a club and with thanks to Roy. That type of thing doesn't tend to happen at Palace. But that is my fear for the rest of this season. Because even after a 1-1 draw against a team that's clearly better than us, people are...
still furious.
Going absolutely berserk. Yeah, I mean, it's worrying, really.
I am genuinely intrigued to see the approach the club take, because, and you cite Luton having two games in hand, that definitely needs to be taken into account. But we are still relatively comfortable in terms of proximity to the relegation zone at this point of the season. The last time Palace went big in January was back in 2017. I think with Allardyce coming in, the window of Luka Milivojevic, Jeffrey Schlupp, Patrick Van Aanholt, Mamadou Sakho's wages coming in as a loan signing. That was because I think we went into that new year period either in the relegation zone or just above it. And Sam Allardyce had presumably signed his contract with the assurances that money would be coming in that January. So will Palace spend money in, and I'm going to say it, listener, a very difficult window to spend money in to get good value. Will they spend that money if the threat of relegation is not as impending as it was back in 2017? I think they will, because I think there has to be an acceptance of the growing fear amongst the fan base and the separation between the club and the fan base. I think there's a set of fans, some may be listening to this podcast, but a set of fans who may, even if we take 4 points, say, for the next two games, will still consider us to be batting below our average, despite the evident lack of quality in that squad. So I think there is a decision to be made by those in the boardroom as to what support they give the manager. Who that manager is, we have a couple of questions which I'll put to you both as well. Matthew Ward, should Roy go sooner than the end of the season? If we had a new manager come in before January, they could assess who, what we need. Who would you want in? Cooper is looking for his next job. And John Dodds, would Steve Cooper have removed the positivity gained from the youngsters' performance versus City by recalling Hughes? So in terms of Steve Cooper specifically, as Dom says, there have been kind of acknowledgement of there being links between the club and Steve Cooper previously. I think before the appointment of Patrick Vieira, Steve Cooper's name was very heavily linked with the Palace vacancy at that point. Dom, do you see there being an actual fit of this Palace squad as it is with Steve Cooper, as so many Palace fans seem to identify?
Again, it's a really good question. One of my journalist colleagues is a Nottingham Forest fan, and was utterly devastated at Cooper's departure from Forest last week. And we were chatting away on WhatsApp, and he said, "Oh, don't worry, you'll have him at the Palace at some point soon, no doubt." And I sort of suggested that there had been contact, and he said, "Oh, but one thing, I read a lot of Palace fans saying that, oh, he'll be brilliant for our younger players because he did so well with the England under-20s. Well, we haven't seen very much evidence of that at Nottingham Forest," he says. The one person that he has done well with is Morgan Gibbs-White, and you could argue that Brennan Johnson was given a chance, but largely because Brennan Johnson was one of Nottingham Forest's best players already at the club. Morgan Gibbs-White was a player that he knew and he has done fantastically well. But I don't think we should suddenly think that if Steve Cooper comes in, that suddenly our under-18s are going to be in our first team, because it won't work like that. I don't know enough about Steve Cooper's style of play, because I think since he came took Forest into the Premier League, they've obviously been fighting a rear guard to stay in the Premier League. And I don't think you really express your philosophy as a manager if you plunge straight into a horrific relegation battle with a squad that's been assembled pretty much overnight, as it was in the summers of 2022 and 2023. So I don't know if anyone really knows how Steve Cooper would fare at a mid-table Premier League club who should be clear of trouble. But I don't think he suddenly... Look, if he did come in at Palace, if he did at some point in the future, and I don't think... I have no indications now that he's likely to be anytime soon, but as I say, he is available. I mean, surely it's someone... He'd want him to have a pre-season with the team to bed in any ideas and philosophy that he's got so that he can work with them, get them to a level of the fitness that is required for his style of football, get them the ideas and the types of movement, the types of passing drills, etc., all that type of stuff sorted in the pre-season. I don't think if he came if he came in now, he would have any chance to do any of that type of stuff, and we probably wouldn't see the Steve Cooper team anyway, because he'd be firefighting from day one. So that's me saying I don't know whether he's coming in or not, and I also don't know how well he'll do. It was interesting with Selzy talking about it. I mean, Selzy seemed pretty unconvinced that he would sate people's appetites for the type of football we want to see at Selhurst, but I don't think anyone really knows because he's not been in that position.
I'll throw to you in a moment, Ed, just in terms of Cooper and your thoughts on the manager situation, but the narrative in terms of Cooper's use of youngsters, it really reminds me of when Peter Taylor was appointed in 2006 as Palace manager, and having so recently been the under-21 manager, people presumed that he'd have the best black book in football and would, you know, fill the Palace team with the starlets of the under-21s at that point, and that didn't happen.
And Scott Flinders.
Yeah, Mark Kennedy lied on his application, but yeah, in terms of Cooper, that is how he became a prominent figure in English football and worked his way through the FA. But as you say, Dom, he hasn't showcased that at Nottingham Forest. He did to some extent at Swansea, in fairness, yeah. And including our own Mark Gay, who he brought into Championship football and utilised very, very well. So I don't know. Maybe it's just that he doesn't have the players at Forest that he thinks he could. And maybe with the talents that Palace have coming through the academy, it could be different. That said, is any manager going to chuck a raft of youngsters in to a team that is in the position in the league where we currently are? So it's an interesting one. Ed, your thoughts on the manager and whether there's anyone else out there that's either, you know, you see Kieran McKenna linked, who's currently in employment at Ipswich. His name has been linked also by Palace fans and anyone who may have a clear idea whether that's a viable option. It seems to be this season's Michael Carrick, who was being mentioned at this time last year. Just wonder whether there's always just someone in vogue that clubs like Palace are looking at. And just your thoughts on Steve Cooper specifically.
In terms of Steve Cooper, I think I've watched Nottingham Forest three times against Crystal Palace in total, and I'm not quite sure what the style of play is, to be perfectly honest. I don't think he's going to come in and revitalise Jordan Ayew and turn him into a 15-goal-a-season striker or winger. I'd love to see what Pep Guardiola could do with this squad, because it's so thin, and the options are you have to keep using the same players week in, week out. You know, we're limited in what we can do from full-back to midfield to attack. Palace are really lopsided at the moment in terms of the way they play, because the left-back can get forward, the right-back can't. The right-winger can attack, the left-winger can't. So it's basically the imbalance in the squad is crazy. There's no sort of, none of it really matches up. But, you know, we talk a lot about if Steve Cooper came in, we'd see all of our under-21s kind of promoted up to the first team. I watch a lot of the under-21s play, obviously have conversations in terms of do a lot of stories around sort of loanees or what might happen, or we'll players who step up to train.
We'll come on to one of those in a part three.
It's players who step up to train with the first team. These are all very talented individuals. And I think we've seen with David Ozo, some one or two maybe have the ability to do it in the Premier League. But when David Ozo came on last night, maybe I'm in the sort of minority thinking this, I don't think he looked perfectly sort of comfortable with the situation. I think he had to be sort of coached through it a little bit. I looked at his stats. He completed 100% of his passes, 10 passes. That's a very commendable stat. But he obviously did very well up against City. But if Palace got in a replacement, say a Wilfred Ndidi or someone else to come in for that sort of 6 months or however long it is to look after Sheikh Doucouré's spot, we'd send David Ozo out on loan. I'm pretty sure of it. I don't think that. He's obviously in Roy's sort of inner circle, golden trust at the moment. But you know, if you have a player like Wilfred Ndidi, who's very similar to Jefferson Lerma in terms of the experience that they've got, I don't think you can see him being picked over David Ozo. So I don't think you can see David Ozo being picked over him. So these players need to go out and earn their stripes and get minutes under their belt before they can really come in. You know, if we were a Premier League club when Wilfred Zaha was coming through, what's to say that he would have had the same sort of impact? He needed the environment where he could flourish, and it's the same for some of these youngsters. I don't get the impression that any of them are bar Ozo at the moment, are sort of banging the door down where you think these guys can do it week in, week out. So for the people saying that Zach Marsh needs to be included in the squad at some stage, it's ludicrous, because Zach Marsh is not ready to be a Premier League striker whatsoever. I don't understand the sort of calls for it. It's very reactionary, but yeah, it's a long way of me saying I don't think Steve Cooper would come in and revitalise this squad by turning it into the Busby Babes of South London, basically.
We will come on, sorry I interrupted you there, we will come on to a story that you have broken this very afternoon in terms of one of our young starlets. I think that we didn't really ask too many questions there, and it was more just a chat. I think it's important, albeit the transfer window doesn't open for at least another two games, and obviously the Steve Cooper situation is out there. So I thought it was just a nice chance to maybe have a broader chat than answer some of the questions. But thank you for your questions, listener. We do enjoy receiving them, and hopefully some of the ones that we got through in the first part have answered those. But please do send them in. Join us after the break for part three, where we'll be playing 3-2-1. Welcome back to the FYP podcast for part three, sponsored by Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. Ed, I touched on it just before the break, but before we do get into 3-2-1, you broke a story about one of our young Eagles potentially getting the green light for a loan move in January. And there's another story about another player from the academy also possibly getting a move. But the story you broke this afternoon, Ed, was about who?
Crystal Palace under 21 striker Ademola Oladebomi. He's obviously been on the bench a handful of times this season under Roy Hodgson. As far as I understand, I think Shrewsbury are sort of leading the race to sign him at the moment. Obviously, Palace have a good relationship with them, having sent Rob Street and Killian Phillips there in previous season, last season. So they're actually the second lowest scorers in League One. So if he went there, I think the main thing would be to get him game time. As I mentioned, for a lot of these youngsters, the jump up from under 21 football, even to League Two football is... I've seen players come to AFC Wimbledon on loan and absolutely flounder. There's no guarantees that these guys are going to come in and sort of hit the ground running. But I think it's important to find the right club where you're going to get minutes. You're going to get a manager who trusts you, understands what your actual strengths are. Because if you look at Ademola Oladebomi as a player, you're going to think that his sort of best threat is through the air. But I think it's a bit sort of like Jean-Philippe Mateta, where he's a bit more technical than that. So, yeah, I mean, obviously... A lot of time to go between now and when the January transfer window actually opens. And as we saw yesterday, Palace do need cover in that position for the first team squad. So I don't think, to caveat it, I don't think he potentially will be going anywhere until a replacement or an extra forward sort of option is brought in. But
as you do say, Ed, if he is being lined up for a move, that probably indicates the club are making plans in terms of the first team, if discussions are to be had with leaving clubs to raise their expectations. And given that he is probably the third choice striker right now, albeit you could probably do that job, it does indicate that maybe plans are afoot. There was another story this morning linking Jack Horns-Morrison with a move to our friends down the road at Charlton Athletic. So we could see a few starlets being let out. The Shrewsbury manager, just by a quick bit of research this morning, Matt Taylor, he of the left foot wand, scorer of many a great goal. I hadn't appreciated he'd gone into management. So, just to make me feel a bit older than I already felt after you not knowing who Bros were, Ed. So, anyway, time for this week's 3-2-1. Quick update as to where we are. We have had a few queries from listener. Jefferson Lerma currently tops the charts ahead of Joachim Andersen, Jean-Philippe Mateta and Mark Gaye. So not to inform your thoughts on this one, but Dom, I'll come to you first this week.
I'll go Nat Klein. Just really impressed with the energy that he's brought to fullback in the last couple of games, really. The Liverpool game, he was very, very impressive in that match. And last night he was up against Mitoma, who has made many a Premier League fullback look daft. He didn't, and in fact Mitoma left the ground on crutches, not because of anything that Klein had done, but you know, I think he felt fairly bruised by the whole experience anyway, and Klein, he played his part in that. It's just nice to see a Palace youth team graduate doing so well still at Palace. I know he's had periods away, and indeed his career has hit the proper heights of England recognition, playing for Liverpool, etc. in the intervening years, but he is justifying the contract that was offered and signed last summer, and actually on the performances that he's putting in now, he doesn't look like a player that whose Premier League career is winding up. It looks as if there might be a few more years left in him.
Yeah, he was exceptional last night. I thought he was kind of close to his best, and it's amazing to think we're just 3 weeks on from the Bournemouth game when he came on at left back and looked incredibly short of confidence, albeit slightly out of position. But to transform his form as quickly as he's done, very good at City, as you say, very good last night. So really pleased for him, and not to preempt the Warnock interview that we touched on earlier that's due to come out in early January, but talking through Neil Warnock, the man who gave him his debut, 15 years of playing for Palace, albeit, as you say, Dom, with spells away. But for a career to span that, and as you say, performances like last night will indicate to Palace or other clubs at this level that there is still a player there who can very much play at this level. Edmund, I guess where you sit, you see fullbacks all the time, and Klein would have taken your eye last night as well.
Yeah, I thought he was absolutely excellent. I had a quick look at for the player ratings. I always sort of have a look at the stats, see how the players get on, so I can form a sort of opinion on that. I think, as I mentioned, I think Mitoma only got past him once, and he completed four interceptions as well. So, he's growing from strength to strength. I think it's going to pose a sort of real query as to what Crystal Palace do in the summer, as Dom mentioned. I'd definitely give Nathaniel Clyne another year extension in terms of keeping him a part of this squad. But it's what happens with Joel Ward. I personally would have made Joel Ward the sort of the fifth centre back, and maybe that's something for them to have a look at in the summer. But I think he's more than capable of still being sort of in and around the squad. And but what Nathaniel Clyne offers in terms of his athleticism is sort of incomparable to Joel Ward. Obviously, Ward's better at the back in terms of aerially and dealing with some of the crosses and corners that comes in. But Nathaniel Clyne's ability to deal with a more pacey winger is a necessity in the Premier League these days. So, yeah, no, he's absolutely excellent.
Yeah. To know all the fuss is about Matoma. Not interested. Anyway, Russell Levy agrees with you both. Did we all write Nat Clyne off too soon? He's been excellent the last couple of games. And thank you, Russell. Ed, your nomination for this week's 3-2-1.
I'd like to give it to Michael Olise.
My tour off the chart. Furious.
Purely for the nutmeg on Matoma, so it was special. I mean, he was in points of that game, grabbing it by the scruff of his neck, and he's been doing that a little bit more recently. I was talking to another journalist who was there yesterday. I was saying he's doing it a bit more sort of Wilf-esque in the way that he's becoming the sort of main man of the squad. I mean, he was doing it anyway last season, and he's a phenomenal talent, and he's going to go on to do even bigger, better things than us in the future. Whether that is at the end of next season or this season, who knows? But a wonderful footballer and a player who seems to be growing and getting better week by week. So he's a joy to watch, and he's the reason you go to football. You pay the entry fees to see what he's going to do with it. Because
love that cliche. Yeah, love that.
Thank you.
Your thoughts on Michael Olise, who got quite a bit of praise from Sky's coverage last night. I take it as well.
Yes, they did. They did go to town on him, but they also said that Jean-Philippe Mateta, his prowess is heading the football, and that people should fling crosses in from left and right. So let's take it with a pinch of salt.
Brighton legend Glenn Murray, wasn't it, talking? Yeah.
No. Muzzin was good. Muzzin was very good in the studio. That's unfair of me. People happen to speak on the spur of the moment watching the game. Elise did very, very well. Yeah. It's a sort of measure of his quality that actually when he does give the ball away, and he did a couple of times in dangerous areas on the edge of his box, giving it back to Brighton on two or three occasions, that you're so exasperated because you know that actually he has such high standards that when he falls slightly off them, you want to sort of, you know, come on now, just go and show them, show the world what you can do. And he did. The one run in the second half where he burst from deep, and Palace had been camped in their own territory. They couldn't get out, and they got the ball to Olise, and he found a way of getting from the edge of his own box to halfway inside the Brighton half, and it was absolutely a magical run. All our best play and moves came from him, usually involving Mateta at some stage, preempting where Jack's going and his choice, no doubt. But he is a joy to watch. I can't wait for the time when we have him and Eberechi as a fit, firing, in rhythm, up to speed, and playing together in harness. And I just hope that we find a finisher to take the chances that they create.
It's something we've seen too a lot of the season. I think obviously Ebbs's minutes last night will count towards the minutes they've shared, but I don't recall one of them passing to one another last night, so it didn't really count from my perspective. But yeah, some lovely touches. Last week, when Joe hosted Postman City, we didn't, and we were called out by Julia Toff, rightly so, we didn't celebrate Michael Olise's celebration against Man City last week, which was probably the most joyous I've seen that man since signing for Palace. So, Julia, it's been referenced. It's out there, and you're right to cite it, because it was a fantastic moment to see a player and a man who's often accused of being so kind of within his shell to have that moment of release, and it clearly meant a lot to him. But, yeah, some lovely touches last night. The guy is just a wonderful player to watch and a real treat for us. But, yeah. As you say, Dom, fingers crossed that we get some time of Olise and Eze playing together regularly for a consistent amount of time. I will be nominating Jean-Philippe Mateta this week, despite my previous assertions this season that he wouldn't get another point. I thought he was absolutely exceptional again last night. I thought the touch that I referred to in the first part was the touch in the second half where he took it out of the sky and sent Lewis Dunk towards Thornton Heath while he headed towards Nord Junction. It was absolutely fantastic, and he battered Lewis Dunk for large parts of that game, and I thought he put himself about really well. The only problem for him is that we didn't have someone to come and do the last 15 minutes, which really that performance required, and it meant that he couldn't contribute for the full 90 minutes to level that he trained for the first 75 minutes. But within that last 15 minutes, one element of his play that he did contribute, and we've often talked about his aerial ability, I recall two very decent headers from our own penalty area that he contributed to the defensive effort. So for me, Jean-Philippe Mateta, for a second week running, is part of the conversation. And yeah, he's playing to a level that I, throughout probably September, October, into November, I just didn't think he was possible of reaching. But yeah, really good performance, and followed up as what we described earlier in the week as probably his best performance in a Palace shirt at City with another very good performance. Same from your perspective, Ed?
Yeah, he was absolutely excellent. Flawless in the way he was sort of bringing the ball down. That moment where he sort of jinked past Lewis Dunk to feed through Eze, it was when he is playing with confidence. He is, again, another player who's a bit of a joy to watch in terms of the chaos that he brings. Nobody really knows what he's going to do. So he was excellent last night. The question is when Otton Edouard is fit, who leads the line. If Mateta continues with this sort of form, it's the same sort of query with the goalkeeper situation, isn't it? Sort of possession is 9/10 of the law. So at the moment, Mateta has the shirt, and once January closes, we'll see what happens. But he's playing with a lot of confidence right now and doing really well.
Dom, I just wonder whether we could apply the same adage to it's 7 o'clock somewhere regarding a cocktail to there's a transfer window open somewhere in regards to Jean-Philippe Mateta, whether it's the Middle East or parts of Eastern Europe, I don't know, start creating different transfer windows, because it certainly does seem to be, and I know listeners are probably bored of us talking about it, but it does seem to be the closer you get to a transfer window, he seems to turn it up a bit.
Yeah, well, I guess there's an element of that being natural, but I'm not sure he's doing it consciously, to be honest. I mean, he's getting these opportunities at periods of the season where the transfer window is, you know, looming larger, or indeed the transfer deadline is getting closer when you go to Plymouth in the League Cup. I mean, it's born of regular game time and feeling a part of things. I imagine it can't be easy being an understudy, a Premier League understudy, where you're getting cameos here and there. And you're basically being asked every time you come on to the pitch, you're either being asked to shore things up or you're being asked to win us a game that we've somehow contrived to either fall behind in or need to win. And there's a lot of pressure involved in that. And now he's actually, since coming on at half-time against Liverpool, he's got a defined role in the team. And let's get it right. He's not, in the 2.5 games that he's played, I mean, Liverpool maybe to a lesser extent, because we had more of the ball in that game. We were more of a threat. But Manchester City and Brighton have effectively been rearguard actions from the start. So he's actually starting a lot of these games. He's not starting in the opponent's half. He's starting halfway inside our own half. And as we camp behind the ball to desperately try and stop a team tearing us to pieces. And he's done that very, very well. And he has sprung forward. He's shown more pace and more ability holding the ball up than I thought he had. Yeah. But that's maybe born of just being part of the team and getting the minutes and playing. And that's not even a criticism of the manager, because I think we've got a very good finisher with his own flaws as well in Odson Edouard, who has, after all, scored 6 times for us this season. You know, he's clearly, by some distance, our leading goal scorer. So it's not as if that Mateta should have been playing like this for a while, but you know, the necessity of the situation has offered him an opportunity and he's taken it. And it will be intriguing to see what happens to him in January, because unlike the goalkeeper situation, we may well sell a striker to buy one. We may have to. I mean, realistically speaking, it may be that Mateta, who was available for periods in the summer and will probably be available again, and might actually, as Ed's written, I mean, he probably wants to be integral every week, and he knows that actually at Palace he probably won't be, you know, when other people get back to fitness. So hopefully his value just goes up sufficiently with a nice little flurry of goals yes, that we can afford someone else.
yes. Keep going, JP. The transfer window's not here yet. Lovely. Okay, so those are our three nominees this week. Nathaniel Klein, Michael Olise, Jean-Philippe Mateta. I'm happy to defer to you guys, but I'm also happy for my own nomination to be kind of placed at number one in terms of Jean-Philippe, because I feel that Klein and Lise may have had better games than Jean-Philippe last night. So I'll let you two battle out between each other in terms of your first place for the 3 points.
I mean, beauty before age, I think, is not the expression.
Go on, Ed, our gift to you. You can allocate the points this week.
Yeah. Sean, I agree with that. He's been excellent in the past couple of outings. So would he go back to the top of the leaderboard?
Oh, are you saying Jean-Philippe for the three?
For the three?
Ooh. Controversial.
I was thinking you guys would place one of yours at the top.
Okay. Hang on, no, let me just check. I thought we were talking about...
No, you can play. No, it wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be enough for him to go top of the charts if that does.
Okay, it's not worth doing it then. I'll give it to Nathaniel Klein. Nathaniel Klein.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. No, that's fair.
This is how they decide Oscars.
Yeah, this is how they do it. It probably genuinely is. Just three people in a Zoom call having a chat, not really knowing what's going on. Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think in terms of that level of performance that he showed last night, I think that's fair. Happy with Elise as two then? And Mateta as one, Ed?
Yeah, that will do. Yeah, I'll sleep well tonight with that. So yeah.
Sleep well with that, lovely. Okay, so that really was a game of 3-2-1 in terms of where we went with that one. Lovely. Okay, perfect. Thank you, gents. Right, join us after the break for a very quick preview of two games coming up at Chelsea and at home to Brentford. Welcome back to this week's FYP podcast, sponsored by Green Kings Sport, where football is more than a game. Okay, let's quickly look ahead to Chelsea away on the 27th and Brentford at home on the 30th. Dom, no cheap Chelsea gags from me, but what have you made of them this season?
Well, they're a team in transition. They're a team that's... with backed by a fan base that are struggling to comprehend the fact that standards are slightly different now under new owners, and that the policy going forward is different, and quite understandably, you know, that's a big, massive culture shift that's happened in a very short period of time at Chelsea. Of course, that has still involved spending ridiculous amount sums of money, but. I don't think you'll find any other club on the planet that would go into this January window where a player that has been picked consistently, has been a key part of the manager's plan, has been given the captain's armband on numerous occasions, is apparently actually available for transfer if anyone stomps up the cash, because we need to buy other players who have no affiliation with this club or no sense of belonging or anything like that. And it is... weird situation, and it epitomised by Conor Gallagher and everything that's going on with him.
It's been a while since we rang the Conor Gallagher bell on this podcast, so it's nice to have him back.
Yeah, and look, Palace, I doubt very much that Palace are in the thinking at all anymore on that particular score. It wouldn't surprise me if a Tottenham or... probably a Tottenham, but maybe a West Ham, something like that, came in for him and did put an offer on the table that Chelsea accepted, which would be baffling for every other club in the country, but not for them.
Not for this.
No, it's fine. They are, for their fans, they're infuriating to watch. I would sort of preach some kind of caution here for Palace fans. They're not awful.
No.
They've got some really good players. They've got a World Cup winner in midfield who has been going through a bit of a tough time of late, but actually, if he's firing, he's a really good player in Enzo Fernandez. They've got a lot of talent in forward areas that just haven't quite gelled. Cole Palmer is a hell of a player. Raheem Sterling is a we all know what Raheem Sterling is, and Nicholas Jackson on his day can be a handful. They've got a good defence. They've got young players. They've got a player that was excellent at Brighton last season in Levi Colwill, who's now playing a mixture of left centre-back and left-back for them. They have got talent everywhere. What they don't have is Reece James, which is a massive bonus for Palace, because Reece James always seems to pull it out of the bag whenever he plays us, usually against Wilfred Zaha, admittedly, but he's now out for 3 or 4 months. They do have injury problems, and they also have a fixture on Christmas Eve, which is a massive bonus for Palace, because they have to go to Wolves on Christmas Eve and play, which is an absolute disgrace, by the way, for this poor... I mean, I know it's Chelsea fans here we're talking about, but that having to make that journey on Christmas Eve,
yeah,
give it a rest. What is that about? This is absolutely insane. But that gives them less time to prepare for this match. Okay, it's a home game for them, but it's not exactly a particularly distant game for Palace either. And that does give Palace a chance. There's an opportunity there.
Yeah, that point hadn't really occurred to me, but there can't be many instances in a Premier League season where one team has a 3-day advantage over their opponents in terms of kind of preparation.
Well, I guess it happens every team, every time a small club plays a club that plays in Europe.
Europe, I guess. And yeah. But in terms of the same competition, yeah, that is bizarre. Yeah, arrangement of fixtures. But yes, the Christmas Eve allocation of a fixture, it's quite bewildering. But in a week that we've had regarding other decisions about the future of football, let's not get into that one, I guess.
Just because I did a quiz the other day on a rival podcast that was around the Chelsea fixture. The last time Palace didn't lose to Chelsea in a game was Roy's first win?
Yeah, Roy's first win.
Roy Hodgson's first win in 2017 when the Chelsea manager was Antonio Conte. They had Tiamui Bakayoko and Thibaut Courtois playing for them, amongst others. Fabregas was at the club already. Yeah, he might still have been there.
Oh, no, possibly not.
He might have gone the previous season, possibly, during the championship winning season. But, I mean, honestly, it's a different era. It's a team from a different era for both of them, obviously. But for Chelsea fans looking at that, there's practically a whole generation of Chelsea fans that just think that every time they play Crystal Palace, they win.
They win, yeah, just give us the point.
12 games on the bounce. I mean, it is ridiculous.
I'll tell you one man who played that day that might accentuate the gap in time between that win or not Chelsea winning, as you put it, Dom. Palace goalkeeper that day was Julian Speroni. And in my head, 2017 is literally last year, but it's not. Brackers, we know Brentford will be a draw, but what's the score going to be?
Well, have we had a 0-0 against them in the Premier League yet?
Yes, we have. The first time we played them at Selhurst, Conor Gallagher hit the bar.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll go for 0-0 again. I think that's a nice way to round off the calendar year at home.
If that is the case, I might stay off Palace Twitter for New Year's Eve.
I think the thing is with Brentford though is that they are not as strong as they were sort of in recent seasons. I mean, the fact that they've brought back Sam and Godos and Neil Morpay, it feels like they've regressed a little bit as well compared to the force they've been in previous seasons. Obviously, they lost stuff at Sheffield United as well not long ago, so. If there is a time to finally beat them, it would be now. If we've got Eber Echiezé ready by that point in terms of his fitness, and with the break in between now and the Chelsea game and even that game, you're thinking that could be his sort of sweet spot to return to the starting lineup. With him and Michael Olise going at that Brentford side as well, they've lost Aaron Hickey for the season. I thought he's been tremendous beforehand. Yeah. Goalkeeper situation, I'm not totally convinced on. So there is an opportunity there for Crystal Palace to actually... You know, we need a home win, don't we? We need a win, full stop. But to get a home win to sort of round off the calendar year would be the perfect scenario. So
it would be wonderful.
I say 0-0 in
Yeah, you're conservatively going for the draw just to keep the pattern. And sorry for listeners that might not know why. I presume it will be. I think the 5 games that we've played against them in the Premier League since they've been promoted have all been draws. Two 0-0s in the first season. 2-1, 2-2. No, hang on. I'll ignore me, listener. But it's definitely been 5 draws so far, but I can't remember. It's been a long year, listener. Sorry. But yes, no, still no Ivan Toney. He's not due back until the new year. But they have still kept their heart, their head above where I thought they would be. I thought they would perhaps struggle even more without him. But as you say, they...
Mbeyeno's a big miss. I mean, he's
a massive miss. He's out for a while now as well. So they will need Ivan Toney to come back fit and firing. Otherwise, they could find themselves maybe in a similar mindset that some of our fan base is at the moment. But gents, that's it. That is that's it for our last podcast before Christmas. So wishing both you and yours a wonderful Christmas. And listeners, thank you. Wherever you are listening in from, season's greetings to you all from us here at FYP. We're incredibly grateful for all of your support and contributions throughout the year. So we hope you enjoy the festive season. JD will be back after the Brentford game with a review of both the Chelsea and the Brentford game, but also, I think, maybe a reflection upon the year of 2023. So from all of us here at FYP, Merry Christmas to one and all. Have a good one and go well.
Podcast Network.